This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we will find out more about the Excel Center. It's newly established in Hammond, and it's a program that will help the struggling working families in Lake County, and in particular, adult students, to give them a chance to actually earn a Core 40 diploma, not just a GED. We'll find out more about that. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore will tell us about the recent celebration, completion of the Muslim celebration of Ramadan that ended on June 24th with an interfaith ceremony that was held in Highland. And we'll also have a conversation with Governor Eric Holcomb, talking with reporters about some of the issues that are ahead for the Hoosier State and some of the matters that take effect this week or in the weeks ahead. Here in Northwest Indiana, we're seeing a lot of changes and programs that are set up that would help serve adult students. One of the programs we're going to find out more about today is an extension of a program that started in South Bend. The Excel Center has been established with the cooperation of not only the Lake Area United Way and some related programs, but also Goodwill. But you see here in Northwest Indiana, you see the Goodwill stores around, and we're going to find out more about how the stores are just part of the mission of Goodwill, in particular in helping not only get people who need training into the type of training and so they can find good paying jobs, but also, in this case, with the Excel Center, helping serve adult students. We have in the studio to talk about it Cindy Cavanaugh, who is the school director for the Excel Center that's just been established in Hammond. We'll find more out about that in just a moment. And Guy Taylor is with us from Goodwill. He's based in South Bend, but of course that includes Lake and Porter and surrounding counties as well, too, here in Northwest Indiana. Thank you both for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Well, I'll kind of open it up first. It's kind of like the chicken and the egg, which comes first, talking about Goodwill and then talking about the Excel Center. Which do you want to start with, Guy?
Why don't we start with Goodwill?
Okay.
So the Goodwill model really has always been about putting people to work. Our mission statement talks about education, job training, and job placement. And so starting the Excel Center program over here in the region really was a natural outshoot of our opportunities that we had to help kind of break down barriers for people to get employment and make the connections between individuals who were really looking to make a step ahead and businesses who are looking to hire people. We have over 50,000 adults in the northwest corner of the state without a high school diploma. And so when we talk about the need for doing that, the need for creating that opportunity, not to get a GED degree, but to get their Indiana High School Core 40 diploma, which really kind of sets this program apart, it just seemed like a natural thing for us to be able to bring to the community.
Working with Goodwill and with people that come in that in turn pick up the training, and in turn a lot of that work, of course, is working with the stores, because the stores are kind of the really visible public part of the Goodwill operation anyway. But the store operation, as you've mentioned, is pretty well known, is what actually helps pay for the education programs and the training and the like here too. In getting people that come in the door to learn how to pick up the skills that in turn will help them out, and a lot of those people I know do work in the warehouses and the sorting centers and things like that that Goodwill has set up for all the items that come in the back door and in turn will go out individuals to individual stores. Do you discover different types of skills that are needed, different types of people that need to have help? And that's why this education program is so important.
Right. So first of all, anybody can walk into the Goodwill model and get help, whether it's walking in to be employed at one of our locations. This coming September, we'll be opening up a career center attached to our new store over in Griffith. Mm-hmm. And those career centers are open to the public. Anyone can walk in and say, help, I'm looking for work. How do I do this thing? And it might simply be writing a resume or going through a job search or maybe getting a little bit deeper and finding out that there's some other barriers that may exist. All of that is free, and you're right, the stores help us do all that. Our local Goodwill is one of 162 Goodwills in the country, and the Goodwill model has always been about helping people get ahead. So when you look at the stores and when you look at those warehouse operations and a lot of the backroom kind of things, those are really training opportunities for people. Our desire and our job and our product really at Goodwill is people. And so when you come into the Goodwill model, you work with us for a while, but eventually we want to see you move beyond us to take those next step along the way. Mm-hmm. And while you're with us, then how do we break down some of those walls that may exist?
Now, Cindy Cavanaugh, if you will, tell us a little bit about the Excel Center. As we said, they've established itself first, at least for our area here over in South Bend, and now the new facility of which you're the director is in Hammond. Tell us more about the Excel Center and how it fits in so well with the plans that not only the Lake County or the Lake Area United Way, rather, but also the Goodwill operations have?
Sure, thank you. It's a free high school for adults, anyone who is 18 and over, looking to earn their high school Core 40 diploma. It, like Guy said, it's not a GED program. It is actually Core 40, like students walking out of Crown Point High School, Maryville High School, any of the Hammond High Schools. It's the same thing that those students earned. Our students will earn the same. In addition to that, they have opportunities to earn college credits, dual credits, and certifications like CNA, welding, childcare worker, anything like that. If we don't provide it on site, we will find somebody to bring in or send our students to get that. In addition to that, we have a drop-in center for our students' children. And we, in South Bend, they have it, and we also plan on continuing it. All of their workers there in the childcare section of the school are certified in HiSCOPE, which is the Head Start program. So while mom and dad are learning, the kids are learning, and which is vital to those children in the family, that they see, okay, mom and dad's learning, I can do this, and you know, it's just kind of stopping the cycle there. Mm-hmm. We also help provide transportation with bus passes. It is an accelerated program. We have 8-week terms. Our classes are 90 minutes each. We haven't have our set schedule yet, but it was somewhere between 9 a.m. and 8 p.m., offering 6 classes throughout the day. Most people come in and expect, okay, I'm here, I'll be able to get my high school diploma in 8 weeks. It doesn't always work that way, because what also is unique about the Excel Center is when we have someone come in, say Susie, and say Susie's middle-aged and she hasn't been in school for a while. Susie brings us her transcripts, and we sit down, one of our life coaches, who also wrap around the student, sits down and say, okay, well, we see here you took a math class, you took an algebra class, maybe 20, 30 years ago, but we're going to have you test in math anyway, just to make sure that we're not setting you up for failure. And so Susie takes a test, and she may need a little bit of remediation. Same thing with Lexile scores. That's the students' reading scores. We do test them for that as well. Again, to set them up for success, that we're not putting them into a class that they just can't handle or aren't ready for. And we also do a writing sample.
That's great. Where is the Excel Center going to be located, or is located in Hammond, that's opening up and going to be in full swing this fall?
Yes. We are going to be in a shopping center that's across from Morton High School. Mm-hmm. It's right on 169th Avenue.
Oh, great. Very, very easy and Very visible location. That's very important, too. In getting this all set up in South Bend, what success stories have you learned that you're able to bring over from the Excel Center in South Bend that can apply here in Hammond?
We have about 300 students that are enrolled right now at the Excel Center. Cindy talked about the drop-in center for our kids. We're actually naming that Kids Excel this coming fall. And when we began that program, we anticipated we would have about 20 or so kids on any given day that will be involved in that program. We have over 50 youngsters on a daily basis now that are coming into the center, that their moms and dads are dropping them off. And one in particular just kind of stands out to me, Chris. Young lad by the name of Markeisha, he was into us earlier in the process, and his mom had started at the Excel Center kind of right out of the gate with us. And when she came walking in, she definitely was not confident with herself. And frankly, he was a bundle of energy. And it became problematic for us at times as we were constantly having to chase him around and kind of get him settled down. Fast forward now about a year later, and Gene's mom's getting ready to graduate from the center. And the young lad was walking down the hallway the other day, and our president came walking in and kind of saw him out there, and he went up to introduce himself to her and shook her hand. And now understand, he's about 5, right? So we go from a young lad that's just kind of all over the place to now a leader, really, in the drop-in center. And she walked him back to the center, and he opened the door, and he turned around, and he said, "Shh, it's quiet time in here." And what's happened is we've watched mom, because of the confidence she's built with the Excel Center and her experiences, kind of now moving forward, and her son's also being impacted by that. She's getting ready to graduate here, has all of her credits done, and we're really excited to see what the next step for her will be.
That's great. Well, we're being joined now by Lisa Daugherty, who is the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way. This is the group here in Lake County in particular that is getting involved with the Excel Center and the overall program. The program, I understand, is broader than just the school, Lisa. Tell us a little bit about this this program in particular that the United Way is so much involved in and how it kind of leads into the Excel Center that's opening in Hammond.
Well, you know, we've launched a new coalition of providers, the faith-based community, government entities, your townships, et cetera. The coalition is called United for Families Network, which the Excel Center is part of. And all of this came about as Lake Area United Way is transitioning to a single issue focus. Its work is going to be directed at helping families that are working but struggling to make ends meet. There's a United Way acronym for this group. Excuse me. It's called ALICE, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. So, again, folks working hard, many cases, multiple jobs. But, you know, the cost of living in Northwest Indiana is pretty darn expensive, and they're not always able to afford the basic necessities, and they're vulnerable.
The important thing about the United Way, Lake Area United Way in particular, is this change, and you've kind of mentioned about this. In the past, United Way has kind of focused on helping a number of agencies, number of organizations, but you've kind of coalesced and kind of morphed in a way, I suppose, into this, like you say, a single focus program. How long did it take to get from the broader picture to this very specialized, or what seems to be specialized, focus now?
Well, you know, there are many other United Ways ahead of us. Of course, we're ahead of other United Ways. But the local agency started looking at this transition probably about 5 years ago, and they spent a significant amount of time talking to other United Ways about their successes, about pitfalls, so that we could avoid those. I joined Lake Area United Way in January of 2015. We had made the decision prior to my arrival to move to a single issue focus. We didn't know what it was. And then in May of that year, we pulled all of our partner agencies together. We announced a 3-year transition because we didn't want to create a hardship for anyone. And we knew that we needed time to identify what our issue was and to understand that issue better. So we are still in that process. We made the decision to move to ALICE, but we're still in the community understanding, you know, talking with ALICE families and employers so that we can understand the barriers that they face.
Let me ask, it seems that with such an ambitious program to take on for this very, very first program within this more narrow focus, that the Excel Center must seem to be a very interesting one, and they seem the United Way seems very excited about taking this all on.
Absolutely. You know, we intend to be, you know, United Way is perfectly positioned to be a backbone organization around this issue. We are not going to be a direct service provider. We don't want to duplicate any efforts. But organizations, you know, like programs like the Excel Center, that's just one great example of programs that are out there helping families, you know, improve their skills, improve their education so that they can acquire better jobs, livable wage jobs, that ultimately, you know, put their household in a far more financial financially stable, you know, position. And so our role is not to provide those services as they do, but to bring these organizations together so that strategically we can identify the best strategies overall for the community. So we're making, you know, meaningful systemic changes at a population level and not just one family at a time.
Now, Cindy Cavanaugh, it sounds like that you folks are all ready for getting going at the Excel Center in Hammond. How long did it take for you to get the center physically set up and be ready to go?
Well, I've only been on board about 2 months, and I believe, Guy, you could probably speak more to this than I can. About a year in the process, I believe.
We've been working for well over a year to find a location, to get all the things, all the ducks lined up and ready to go.
Well, that's great. Well, it sounds like that the XL Center in Hammond is going to be ready to go to follow through on the examples and the great work that the XL Center set up in South Bend is going to do. Again, it's an opportunity for adult students and people who are involved in the community that need the assistance to help re-educate themselves or to perhaps improve their education, to bring themselves, if they hadn't finished up high school, if they were dropouts, to be able to get their degrees, to get their diplomas, rather, and in particular, the Core 40 programs, which is the important one that all Indiana public schools, if you go through high school, is what you end up getting is a Core 40 diploma, as opposed to the simple GED. And it should be a very, very interesting program, and the best of luck. We wish everybody involved in the program. With us to talk about it, here in the studio, we have Guy Taylor, who's with the Goodwill Operation. It's based in South Bend, but it includes Northwest Indiana as well, too. Cindy Cavanaugh is the new school director for the new XL Center in Hammond. That is following through on the example of the XL Center in South Bend. And with us as well, too, Lisa Daugherty, the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way, which is the support group behind this new XL Center that is opening up in Hammond. Thank you all for being with us. We appreciate you taking time to talk about the program. And again, the best of luck to you as you go into a new academic year here and we get more people involved in Northwest Indiana and getting the education that they need, not only to make themselves feel better, but to be better prepared for the workplaces. We see the changes that are happening here. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you.
And you're listening
to
Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Muslim celebration of Ramadan ended on June 24th. The month-long ceremony towards a deeper faith ended with a call for non-Muslims to visit the Iliana Mosque to get a better understanding of the world's second largest religious faith. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore talked to a local Muslim leader about the observance that's just ended.
The Iliana Mosque Interfaith Ramadan celebration is part of the Muslim community's outreach to create a better understanding between themselves and the larger community. Dr. Muhammad Kudami is president of the Iliana Islamic Association.
We started this a year ago, so it will be our second event there. Ignorance is probably the enemy of all of us there. You know, when you are not familiar with somebody else, you tend to mistrust them, fear them, whatever it is. So the road to mutual understanding, mutual respect, is probably knowing each other.
Leaders here at the Iliana Mosque say they are encouraged by the role the courts are playing in the decision about the Muslim ban.
This is a testimony to democracy in the United States, where the system has its checks and balances there.
People who attended the service asked questions about how Islam differs from Christianity. They were told that they have many similarities.
Respect for your neighbor. Love for the others what you love for yourself. This is stated clearly in all faiths. Respect for human life, essentially, the sanctity of human life.
Organizers also face questions about why women and men are separate during services. The explanation? Having women and men together, they say, would cause a distraction, and they want to be focused during prayer services. Dr. Kudami says better relations through better understanding will help everyone.
When we know each other, we hopefully can build bridges and trust each other and work together. We're here on this earth, to make it a better place. That's how I believe.
In Highland, Indiana, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
Well, we've learned about programs that are helping adult learners, in turn, get into the workplace. And let's go back even further to young people, a new way to help the families of young Porter County students get ready for college or other educational opportunities after high school. We'll get underway this fall. Promise Porter County is coming to all 7 school districts in that county. And Julie Georgie came on Regionally Speaking recently to talk about it.
Well, we're very excited to be bringing this to Porter County. It's been a couple years in the making. The Promise Indiana organization has been around for about 4 years, started in Wabash, Indiana, and the idea was to enroll every first grade family that, well, they did K through three, but we are going to do first grade families in a free college savings account through College Choice 529, which is Indiana's college savings plan. So the plan is we have 28 individual schools in Porter County and over 1,800 first graders. So come next fall, we are going to be at various back-to-school events at every school, enrolling these students, the families that want to, in the program. They will get a initial deposit, generously donated by Urschel Laboratories, of $25 into their account. They don't need to do anything to get that. Simply enroll, and if that's all they want to do the whole time, that's all they have to do. But we're going to also be encouraging them through some college and career curriculum in their first grade classrooms to start thinking about what it's going to mean to go to college, what they might like to do, just various aspects of heading on to post-secondary education. And then we'll have a period of time called the Champions Match, where we're going to encourage these first graders and their families to go to their champions. It may be family members, friends, coaches, teachers, anyone that they would go to, and ask them to support them in their quest to go to college.
Now, there's some interesting facts and figures that have come out here from the state, and I know you've looked them over, and I'm sure a lot of this has been some good ways to encourage support of the program. But it's a benefit for family members to get started very early in trying to set up savings accounts for their children's education.
College savings plans have come a long way in the last 10 or 15 years, and 529 plans are the best way to save for college right now. There are tax advantages. The money can be used it's generous in terms of what you do. It doesn't have to be a traditional four-year college. You can go to trade or technical schools, two-year colleges. You can use it for even textbooks and computer expenses. So they're very generous in how you can use it, and as long as they're used for educational expenses from any program that takes federal financial aid, they can withdraw the money tax-free. So that's just a huge benefit to families. And if you start early, then the money has this chance to grow. We're going to, as I was talking about the champions, we will match if the families are able to put in $25 of their own money during our champions period, which will be in October, we will match that $25 with an additional $25. So potentially by the end of October, the kids could have $75 or more in their savings account already.
Now, take us through the start of the program. We know it's going to get underway with the beginning of the 2017-2018 school year in all of the Porter County school districts. What will parents have a chance to see or do when school starts, or maybe they'll get something in the mail before classes get underway to tell them more about this program, about the 529 College Savings Account program, as well as the local program, and how they can get involved?
Yes, we've already been in contact with every first grade family through email and through a letter that went home to kind of tell them what to look for come fall. And we will continue to be in contact with them through their school, through their individual schools, over the course of the summer as the plans finalize for their each individual enrollment. So that they will come to a back-to-school, it could be a back-to-school evening, it could be registration. Each school was able to kind of select which event they thought would work best for them. And then they will come into the school, have the opportunity to either do this online, in the computer lab, or we also have we'll have paper and pencil that if they would prefer to do that like in that way. And once they've done the online registration, because even if they do paper and pencil, they'll have to confirm online eventually. Once they do that, we'll put the money in their accounts a month or so later, and they'll be ready to go.
Now, Julie, I understand that there are going to be some very interesting activities that are going to be involved. You might have mentioned that here at the outset of our conversation, but one in particular, where participating first graders and family members are going to have a chance to visit a big campus. At least it's big to them. They're young people. They're little people. They probably aren't used to, unless they've been to Valparaiso University for other reasons, they're probably going to be very impressed with what they see.
Exactly. That's an event called Walk Into My Future, and we are going to hold that in April of 2018. And I actually was just meeting with the Valparaiso University contact today. So we're that's a great topic to talk about right now. I'm all excited about it.
That's Julie Georgie, who is the coordinator of Promise Porter County, which is a program that gets underway this fall that will help get first graders set up for College Choice 529 savings accounts. A Purdue University Northwest faculty member is looking into how preschoolers best learn to count and these related numerical concepts that they are picking up along the way. We're talking with Assistant Professor of Psychology Lori Peterson, who works on the Hammond campus, looking into this project. Lori, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, if you will, what prompted your interest in this topic in particular, taking advantage of young people who happen to be on the Hammond campus as your subject studies.
I've been working on children's counting skills since I was at graduate school at Notre Dame. I started getting interested in this topic of children's, the knowledge that they come to school with. In college, I heard about data sets that suggested that American children underperformed same-age children in other countries. And so I was very interested in figuring out what we could do as instructors, as researchers, to try to combat that trend. And one really important piece of research came out in 2007 from a research group suggesting that the knowledge that children have about math by the time that they start school not only predicts their math performance throughout elementary school, throughout childhood, it also predicts their reading knowledge, too, so their reading ability, their achievement. And we know that the kids who start off, by the time they start first grade, by the time they start kindergarten with good math skills, those kids are more likely to graduate high school and go on to college. So I was really interested in starting out early on in life. And so one of the first math skills that children learn is counting. What we researchers in developmental psychology, which is the research area that I'm in, in my field of research, one thing that we know is that there's very little research done on counting in particular. So we don't know very much about the conditions, the particular counting practice settings that are most effective for kids. Like, so at home or at school, should children be using counting books, which are highly available, or should they be doing different types of objects as counters. Mm-hmm. When you go into a supply store that supplies teachers with materials that they can use in their classrooms, there's a whole bunch of different varieties that teachers can choose from. So they can choose from really relatively plain disc-like counters to use to help their children practice counting, or they can use really interesting ones like little animals or little pieces of fruit to help them practice counting. So teachers have a lot of choices available to them, but they have relatively little guidance in terms of what might be most effective for them.
Do you think we'd need more books that might help to kind of get away from the object counting?
That's what my research suggested in graduate school. So for my dissertation, that's exactly what I studied. I was really interested in whether it's better for children, whether children learn more from their counting practice when they're practicing with books or when they're practicing with actual objects. And that's what my research suggested in my dissertation study. It suggested that those children who practice with counting books, they tend to learn more from this counting practice. So they become better at counting, actually, at the end of my study, at the end of the intervention. And so what I wanted to do here in Hammond is I wanted to repeat the same study, but do it a little bit more naturally. In my dissertation, I had a very controlled study, and when children were practicing with objects, they were practicing with objects that were kind of contained on a sheet of paper to make it as similar to the book condition as possible. But what I worried about as a researcher is that if children are practicing with objects on a piece of paper, it's a little unnatural compared to how children would typically practice with objects. And so that's what I've been working on here at the Riley Center. with 10 children so far, although I'm hoping to work with more children this summer and into the next semester, this next fall as well.
We're talking with Assistant Psychology Professor Lori Peterson, who is a professor at Purdue University Northwest on the Hammond campus. She's also a native of Michigan City, so she has an interest in what region kids are doing and how they're learning, in particular how to, they learn how to count, and what kind of skills those counting skills will bring them when they start studying a more math concepts, especially as they go on through elementary school and into high school as well. Professor Peterson, from what you have found so far, you notice that maybe that the book learning might do better than doing the actual object counting. How can this apply to future skills that students will pick up in higher classes, even through elementary school, in learning their math concepts?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So first I would say that the reason why counting is so important is because it's considered a foundational skill in math. So you need to understand how to count to three, for example, or what exactly three is in order to add it to two to get to five. So you need to know how to count to do arithmetic. So it's foundational in that sense. But what does it say about the types of objects that we should use in classrooms later on in school for later math topics? Well, that is an ongoing question. So there's a very big debate, I would say, in developmental psychology about whether we should be using objects in the classroom. By the way, these objects, when they're used in this sense, are called manipulatives.
Mm-hmm.
So manipulatives are these objects like maybe toy clocks we would use, or perhaps these little digit tiles that we might use in the math classroom to make these kind of abstract concepts more relatable to children.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So on one side of this debate, people think that we should, some researchers think that we should make these objects really, really interesting to capture children's attention and make them more motivated. On the other side of the debate, people suggest, some researchers suggest that we should be using really plain manipulatives. And the reason for that is because the less interesting an object is, the easier it will be for children to actually use it as a symbol. It's supposed to symbolize or represent some sort of mathematical concept.
Well, do you think it maybe distracts them, perhaps? If the little object distracts them from what they should be doing, that is thinking about counting?
Yes, exactly. And that's exactly what my research on my dissertation with the counting book versus object study suggested.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that the children who were using the objects, they were just very distracted by them. So instead of using those objects in a beneficial way, like moving them out of the way when they've already counted them, they simply just used them for play, or the vast majority of children did. And so that suggested to me that that was a major reason why objects were less effective than counting books for them to learn the counting skills.
You talk about how counting is basically a very, very strong foundation for further math learning, especially in grade school into high school and maybe for some even into college. As we see this emphasis on STEM fields, on science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and we see that the learning works into that direction to help build the jobs of the future, the careers of the future. You think that this is probably one of the best ways to build that foundation by learning better how to count?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I that's why I'm very interested in math in particular, for the exact reason that you said. When children are better at math, when they're more comfortable with math, they're more likely to go into these highly lucrative STEM careers, as you suggested. And these highly lucrative STEM careers are an important driver for our economy, and I think especially for our future economy. But I think it's not only getting children to understand the math concepts. I think another really important component of this is getting Americans in general less afraid of math. I think a very large problem with children here is what we call math anxiety, a specific fear about math.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that I work, that's another strand of my research that I work on as well, is interventions that we can use to improve people's attitudes about math.
Now, you get to work with the director of the Riley Child Center, Tamara Bottomley, on this project. What has she had to say when you had to approach her about what you would like to do and how things are coming along so far? What's her reaction been?
She's been really excited to learn about this research and also the teachers as well. She's been very enthusiastic. I've been very, very, very fortunate to have the Riley Center to partner with on this research. You know, as you can imagine, at a preschool center, at a child learning center, they're very interested in the best ways that children learn. So she's been very enthusiastic, and it's been wonderful to work over there.
And you think that maybe that as your research goes on, that you'll be able to help put some of what you've learned, the procedures that you've determined are the best ones, are going to help the youngsters the most as they progress along through life. You think that they'll put some of those ideas and practices into practice there at the center?
I think so. And my hope will be to continue working with them and communicating with them about my research. I think that's one really important thing for psychologists and other fields of research to do, is to communicate these findings out to the public. We haven't always been in the past as good at that as we should be, reaching out to the people that these findings might directly affect. But I think that's a really important component of the research process.
We've been talking with Assistant Psychology Professor Lori Peterson, who is a member of the faculty at Purdue University Northwest Hammond campus. She has been working with young people who are at the daycare center there on the Hammond campus to find out more in her study as to how preschoolers best learn to count and any related mathematical concepts that they can pick up there, as well as what they'll learn when the rest of the time that they spend in the classroom and the rest of their lives. Thanks very much for being with us, Professor Peterson. Good luck to the research, and I hope you find out some interesting things, and we'll learn about them later, that they actually get implemented in schools all across not only Indiana, but the country, perhaps. And thanks for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you.
Well, since that conversation, we've learned that Riley Child Center is closing on Friday after more than 40 years of service, and the university officials say it's because of enrollment decreases at the child care center, as well as increased costs for operating it. So Professor Peterson's no doubt going to have to expand her research elsewhere. Governor Eric Holcomb spent some time this week talking with the Indianapolis radio talk show host Abdul Hakim Shabazz and with Network Indiana's political reporter and State House Bureau Chief Eric Berman about some of the issues ahead for the Hoosier State. And they include the fuel tax increase that takes effect across Indiana on Friday. It's connected, of course, with the infrastructure improvements that are ahead that would pay for it. I-69 is another topic they talked about, and the governor's agriculture plan. Hakim Shabazz begins the conversation with a question.
With some of the things we've seen in the news lately, can Hoosiers feel comfortable about how their money is going to be spent and how roads are going to get done?
Well, Hoosiers expect good roads, and being in the crossroads of America, you know, I was just on a trade mission overseas in Europe, and I said we were at the crossroads of the universe, and we want to make sure that all roads lead to Indiana, and to do that, we got to pay for them, and it was time to have a long-term, truly sustainable, data-driven plan, and that'll kick in on July 1, and we'll have the funding to be able to maintain what we have. That's what taxpayers expect and deserve. That's what they pay for, and we'll be able to finish projects that are going to continue to draw in investment to the state of Indiana like nobody's business. So I am eagerly awaiting July 1 to get here. And like I said, you're going to be able to smell asphalt morning, noon, and night. It means progress.
You and others said during the legislative debate on this plan was, you know, people are willing to accept a tax increase as long as they see something for their money. Yeah. With all the news that Abdul alluded to with I-69 being behind schedule, how do you assure folks as they go to the pump that their money is going to be well spent?
Well, they're going to be driving on it. And we have a good track record of the state of Indiana has a good track record of finishing projects that we start. And over the last 10, 12 years that I've been associated with state government. So we are driving over the bridges over the Ohio River. We are going to finish I-69. We're not just talking about starting it or studying it. We're going to drive on it to completion. And that won't just be linking Evansville to Indianapolis. That's going to be linking a trade region, meaning three different countries, Mexico, America, and Canada, like never before. There won't be that missing link. And so Hoosiers will be able to judge for themselves, not just the conditions of the roads and the improvements, but also the added increase to all the local governments. This is about a $342 million addition to local governments. And so when we're trying to attract companies to Indiana, we have to make sure that we're able to complete the infrastructure to the front door of that business in the county that they they choose to locate in. And this is going to enable counties now to complete those projects as well. So it's a real partnership between local officials and state officials. And now we're going to stand out as a state that has the funding to actually pay for the projects that need to be completed. Not a lot of states can say that. Our neighbor of the West can't even get a budget, let alone pay for the roads that they have. So we're in a great position to capitalize off of our location, location, location. But you have to pay for it.
Any worry or concern that the focus may be a little bit too much on, is the focus going to be, I'm sorry, finishing what we have or, you know, fixing and maintaining? Which one is going to get the priority? Because some people might say, well, this pothole is still on my state road, even though they're fixing the interstate down the road.
Well, it's not an either-or. I mean, we have our priority list that we'll be putting out, and you'll be able to access that online no matter what county you live in. The Department of Transportation will be very transparent about the projects that we're undertaking, and taxpayers deserve that as well. They deserve to know where their projects are and the status of them. So it's not an either-or. You don't get to choose. We're going to make sure that we maintain our state roads and we complete the projects that we have on the books that are prioritized, and that we start to then in years 12 through 20 start to look out over the horizon and say, what's next? And this will allow us to do that.
OMB has not released the numbers on the old P3 with the I-69 group or the projections for the new deal that was announced last week. Why not? Is that not something taxpayers also deserve to know?
Well, IFA will be very transparent about this. I suspect we'll end up saving money at the tail end of it, and I'd refer you to them, to the IFA, and obviously the figures will be for public consumption. But they're going through them right now. We think that at the end of the day, when this is all finalized, we'll be able to save money, understanding that the project has been delayed. But here we are, and moving forward, my goal is going to be not just to talk about finishing, but actually drive on it, and that'll happen.
Speaking of agriculture, one of the provisions in the plan is to increase agriculture education in K through 12. Yeah. Representative Leahy's bill didn't go anywhere this past session trying to get that in. Of course, it was tied to school improvement. Yeah. What can be done there?
Well, it's, you know, one thing I've learned over the course of the last decade is it's never a one-inning game, and you have to come back. If first you don't succeed, try again. And this is an area where I agree with Representative Leahy that it's important that our students, when they leave high school, that they're holding a ticket to their success in their hand. Agriculture education is critically important in a vast part of our state. And as technology intersects with agriculture of yesterday, we have to make sure that we're equipping our students with the skills that they need. I was, like I said, I was just on a 9-day trade mission in Europe, and we were hearing about Uber combines and flying cars. And so we know what folks are thinking about, and we're going to have to be prepared for that knowledge economy that's coming our way, including on the ag front. Indiana, because of, like I mentioned, Agrinovis and our partnerships with our universities, we have so many assets that are so attractive to investors. We have to make sure that we're harnessing all that energy, and it starts with kids and getting out of high school and going to work or college, but that's where it starts.
All right, two more.
How does this plan fit into the strategy of your government?
Well, you know, this is what set Indiana apart on so many different fronts. Is we've not just admired problems or challenges ahead of us, but we've sat down, we've brought the stakeholders together, we've made room at the table for positions and perspectives, and then we emerge with a plan in hand, and then we go about executing it, whether it's got to do with infrastructure or our ag strategy or our dairy strategy. But having a plan in hand is critically important. It also is important to the market so that folks know that there is certainty and predictability when they are looking at where to invest. And so this plan is right down that strike zone, and it'll play a critical part about us continuing to grow our ag investments.
So overall,
I'm sorry, Governor, I don't know. I came out in Indiana or negatively affect them in some way or even
We'll monitor it, but I'll let the federal government speak for itself as they review the trade agreements, the federal trade agreements.
All right, thank you.
So otherwise, how was Europe?
It was a blur in a good way. It was very productive. Indiana jumps off the map. We met with a long list of companies who all pointed out how unique Indiana's standing is in the country. As I mentioned, we provide certainty and predictability. Our economy is strong and getting stronger, ever more diversified. We now have a long-term infrastructure program in place that they know that we can pay for. And they know that we're leaning into what we need to do to skill up our workforce across the board. Indiana finds themselves in this interesting position where we have jobs, thousands, tens of thousands of jobs that are available right now. We have to make sure that we're connecting people with their futures, and that's what we'll be all about as the years ahead unfold.
It's Governor Holcomb talking with Indianapolis radio talk show host Abdul Hakim Shabazz and with Network Indiana's political reporter and State House Bureau Chief Eric Berman. A new reporting tool from the Indiana State Department of Health breaks down 39 ways that Hoosiers commonly die, and it shows a recent drastic increase in the number of Alzheimer's disease deaths. From 2011 to 2015, the most recent year with the data that's available, deaths because of the neurological disorder increased 25%. Unlike other chronic diseases, there is no known cure for Alzheimer's. In fact, scientists still aren't sure what it causes in other patients. Natalie Sutton is the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association of America's Greater Indiana Chapter. She says that the statistics on mortality may be due to more people being diagnosed with Alzheimer's or simply admitting that they have it. And she says the figures correlate with overall incidence of Alzheimer's as well.
The number one risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is aging. So we are seeing the baby boomer population, beginning to get in that older range, and we're seeing an increase in cases, not just deaths.
Sutton says that part of that may be due to a stagnation in how the condition is treated, especially when it's compared to breakthroughs that have been made in the treatment of other diseases.
For some of those other disease states, there are new effective treatments, and we haven't seen new developments in research in recent years.
Natalie Sutton says that an aging American population is also being diagnosed with Alzheimer's at a greater rate than ever before, and that's helped make people more likely to identify themselves as suffering from the disease. In 2015, more than 2,500 Hoosiers were reported to have died from Alzheimer's. The city of Gary is putting this year's grant of more than $163,000 in the city's challenge from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation to work toward a well-known but neglected downtown landmark. Men Clement was with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about that landmark, the City Methodist Church.
The edifice has been abandoned for over 30 years, but structurally, filmmakers, particularly and photographers, find the sanctuary area very interesting. It's very scenic in terms of film, and also the theater area within the church. And it's not economically feasible or viable for a film company to recreate that sort of environment. So they find coming here to Gary and finding something so breathtaking to be very advantageous for filmmaking.
I understand that there have been a number of films that producers have come in and taken advantage of for certain scenes that they've used in their films. Tell us about some of the more notable ones and maybe about some ones that people hadn't realized that you actually do get to see a little bit of Gary, Indiana in it.
Well, I'll just name a couple. Perhaps the most well-known, Michael Bay brought the third installment of Transformers, that motion picture franchise, here to Gary. And they did some filming within the church as well as some other areas in the city. Also, A Nightmare on Elm Street was also another Michael Bay project. And then most recently, Netflix brought in two seasons of a series called Sense 8. That's S-E-N-S-E and the number 8. And Gary showed quite prominently in both seasons of that particular show.
Now, since you've been in the church and certainly in recent months here, and you've had a chance to check just about everything out from not only upstairs in the sanctuary but down into some of the places in the basement, what are some of the things that you note that might be the first to be able to get worked on, maybe I should say, when the crews finally come in here, they do the structural assessment and actually want to start getting some work together to get this ruins garden and the event space going?
Well, I can't speak specifically to that project because I'm not engaged in that. However, if I had to garner a guess, I would say they probably started looking at the sanctuary area because that's the most breathtaking and that's the most attractive. And I would imagine they'd like to take a look at that to see if it's structurally sound enough to do some work in there and to render that particular area viable for events and what have you.
Do you think there's a chance that maybe you'll at least lend some expertise or some information to them at the redevelopment department that they might want to use in working with the contractors and whoever is working on this project?
Well, I can tell you the last thing you want to call me is an expert.
But you've certainly spent a lot of time taking pictures, and you've been through there, and you've probably seen things, and you know what it's like in there. Because I know that on the website, you offer some advice for people that might want to check it out. Number one, it's very, very dangerous in places. You do not want to go into places, even though it may look rather benign and very sturdy. It's not so, I understand. So it's a lot to see there, a lot to work with, and certainly seems like the City of Gary, in this next project they're getting from the Knight Foundation Cities Challenge, I have a great opportunity to turn a real, I guess what some people might call an eyesore, certainly what some people call an architectural wonder, even though it is in ruins, something to look forward to. Ben Clement is the director of the City of Gary's Office of Film and Television, and he is also the creator of the website that is out there on the old City Methodist Church. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, it's Thursday, and that means it's Reporters Roundtable Day. And among the reporters that'll be with us, we have from the Post-Tribune, Javante Anderson and Carrie Napoleon and Carol Carlson. And from Inside Indiana Business, Andy Ober will join us once again with some news around Indiana's business scene. Topics are going to include, for discussion, the new towing ordinance that is in place for Lake County. The Superfund demolition is planned in an East Chicago neighborhood, and a public meeting about that. And Anthem is planning to have a $115 million data breach settlement that they've reached. We'll find out more about that and more as well, too, on Regionally Speaking tomorrow. We hope that you'll join us for the program.